the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We have three bills that are scheduled for a public hearing and possible work session. We also had another bill, Senate Bill 233, scheduled for work session today. Unfortunately, we will not be able to move forward on Senate Bill 233 today because we're waiting for the fiscal. There was a dash two amendment that has come in, and because of that, we're waiting for the final approval on the fiscal. So that's going to be set over and reset once we get the fiscal. So if you're here on 233, realize it won't be heard today, and we will move forward on it as soon as we get the proper paperwork in place. So with that, we have a choice of who's starting and where we're going.
Mr. Taylor should do Senate Bill 74.
All right. Bill? All right, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 74, Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 74 comes to you at the request of the Governor's Office. The bill requires a person on probation or parole applying to have his or her supervision transferred to another state so the person can move to the other state, pay an application fee, directs that the money collected be used to pay costs incurred in retaking offenders who have had their supervision transferred and then have violated the provisions of their probation or parole. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is connected to the interstate compact that we joined about 8 or 9 years ago, and under that interstate compact, they now require us to go out and return people that we would not have sought to return in the past, for example, a person who's on probation for a misdemeanor violation.
All right, thank you. I have one person that's scheduled for testimony at this point, Fran Leschenko. And when you're ready.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Fran Leschenko, and I'm the Director of Extradition Services for the Governor. The Arrest and Return Program pays for the return of Oregon fugitives, offenders who have absconded from parole and probation supervision, and offenders who have outstanding, unadjudicated criminal charges in Oregon. The current level of extradition funding does not allow for extraditions of all fugitives as the cost is prohibitive. Therefore, the Governor's Office has extradition priorities that guide the decisions as to who Oregon extradites. The lower-level offenses with very high extradition costs are less likely to be returned to the state. The Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision is an interstate agreement that provides for the transfer of persons who are subject to probation or parole supervision among the states. The compact permits offenders who are on parole or probation supervision in one state to reside in another state under certain circumstances. New compact rules mandate Oregon to retake or extradite any compacted individuals upon the request of the receiving states, generally because the offender has violated the terms of his or her supervision. If a compacted individual flees the original receiving state to another state, the new compact mandates that Oregon retake the offender from any location nationwide, regardless of the cost or the severity of the underlying offense. The new compact rules eliminate Oregon's discretion in determining which offenders Oregon will pay to return to Oregon. We anticipate that this could significantly increase the extradition costs associated with compact offenders, something that was not contemplated in the current funding for the arrest and return budget. Senate Bill 74 will amend the current statute to provide the authority to impose an application fee on adult criminal offenders who apply to transfer their probation or parole supervision to another state. It will provide that the application fees be deposited into a new subaccount of the arrest and return budget. The subaccount is designed for exclusive use to fund the retaking of offenders subject to the compact. Your approval of this fee will avoid us needing to use arrest and return dollars that are allocated for non-compact extraditions or to seek additional general fund dollars.
All right, thank you. Questions? Fran, I have got a few for you. I want to open up the door here on the compact. I mean, this is one of those, what I call, I'm not going to say unintended consequences, but it's a situation that we basically have, by going into the compact, have given up our ability to be independent of whatever decisions are made by those states that are a part of the compact. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Chairman, that is correct.
Okay, so then when Mr. Taylor gave us the overview, I understand now we may potentially be bringing back misdemeanors that are covered under the compact. I guess that's based on the charges that they are facing?
Mr. Chair, we do, if an A misdemeanor or misdemeanor is compacted to another state, we are required to bring them back.
All right.
And the way it works is that the application for the compact is handled through the Department of Corrections, and there are certain criteria that the individual, the applicant, needs to meet in order to be accepted by the other state for compact supervision. And once that occurs, then the other state can ask Oregon at any time to return the individual for any reason.
Let me walk through a couple of scenarios. I want to just get some stuff on the record so we have a record here. So if you have a person that's convicted of DUI, driving under the influence of intoxicants, which is a Class A misdemeanor, if they want to be supervised out of state, they go through this process, and let's say they are seeking to be supervised in California, and at some point California, for whatever reason, I don't know if there's a criteria for them to say, we don't want to supervise this person any longer. They just make the request back to the state and say that we want this person to be returned to your state. Then that's when we kick in the obligation to return the person?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Is there any type of, use the word discretion, flexibility, if a state requests it, it sounds like it's mandatory.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a certain latitude. I think that mandatory return, it's mandatory after three significant violations. Our Deputy Compact Administrator does have the latitude to maybe work with the other state and seek extension of the parole or probation of the individual in the other state. But when it comes right down to it, if the other state is pretty adamant, then we are required under the compact to return the individual. And also, if the individual flees, say the individual is being supervised in Washington for the state of Oregon, and the individual flees Washington, the state of Washington can close their compact case, advise Oregon, and then Oregon is required to issue a nationwide warrant for the individual. So if the individual ends up in Bar Harbor, Maine, and it's an A misdemeanor, we are required under the compact to return the individual.
Okay. And then I guess the last question is the application fee. Can you kind of walk us through as to what type of cost we're looking at? Because just the couple of scenarios we're talking about, the cost to actually return would be pretty significant.
Mr. Cherry, returning, are you talking about the application fee set or the actual cost of returning an individual?
My understanding was that the application fee was going to be a means to offset the cost if we needed to actually execute on returning the person back to the state. I understand this is going to go into a fund. It's not going to be dollar for dollar or specifically for that individual, but there will be a fund that can be used to extradite people back to the state who are on or out of state under supervision.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. The application fee is going to go into a sub-fund. It'll be like an insurance pool, and then as needed to return or retake these individuals, that money will be used to cover the cost. And right now, the costs of extradition are very expensive when we have to send officers or use commercial airlines. We're looking at, from the East Coast, easily $2,500 per extradition. And this is nationwide, so we're looking at Alaska and Hawaii, too, which those costs are even higher.
Okay. The last question I have is there a means currently, upon returning the person back to the state, to try to have the actual fees that it costs to get the person back here recovered from them besides the use of this sub fund based on the application fee?
Mr. Chair, member of the committee. We do. What we've been doing is working in concert with the Department of Corrections when an individual is compacted and violates their compact and we are required to bring them back. We do ask that the Department of Corrections impose the cost of the extraditions as a way to reimburse the state for the cost of that individual's extradition. So I do get restitution money that will be going in to the new sub-account in conjunction with the application fees. And my understanding with the Department of Corrections that an individual cannot be recompacted until all of their extradition costs have been paid.
Right. One other question, now that you brought up this going to the Department of Corrections, since the Department of Corrections are dealing with felons, and we've been using the scenarios with misdemeanors, does all this apply? I mean, would we actually be using the Department of Corrections for this process if it's something that came that's only a misdemeanor?
Mr. Chair, I'm a little confused with the question.
Okay, let me, my perspective, as a city prosecutor, we prosecute Class A misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. And so they don't, the potential sentence that they have is a one-year sentence. That one-year sentence is not going to put them into the Department of Corrections jurisdiction or authority or under there. And so they're going to basically be either under the authority of the municipal court, they're going to be the municipal jail or the county jail. So how does that work for those individuals?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the local control supervisory authority, those individuals that are being supervised at a county level are subject to the compact also. So not only do we have the Department of Corrections that will be processing compact cases, but we also have compact cases being processed at the county level.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Other questions?
Yes.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. This appears to create a new fee that is open-ended for the Department of Correction to set at any level they want to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wissett. This bill or this was drafted so that this fee could be set in administrative rules with the Department of Corrections, taking into account the fact that some people may not be able to afford to apply or afford to pay the application fee. So we're looking at having a waiver of fees in cases that are deemed necessary for that. But it will be set by administrative rule.
Follow up?
Yes.
That perhaps addresses my other concern is that it would seem to me that a large application fee could have a chilling effect on somebody's ability to have their supervision transferred to another state, to get away from gang violence, to get away from to find a job, to get back to where their family lives or whatever. And so you're saying that the reason for leaving it open is so the Department of Corrections will be able to adjust their fee to allow to avoid that unintended consequence?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wissett, that is correct.
As I read this, the purpose of this fee is limited to providing funds for the extradition of someone who has been transferred from this state to another state under the compact and has reoffended and has to be brought back. It isn't a fee for any extradition, but just extradition of those people who have been transferred and then have reoffended in the different state and are to be brought back. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Witt, that is correct. This will be exclusively used for compact retakings only.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Bormici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do other states in the compact have similar fee provisions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, yes, I'm aware that the state of Idaho has a similar statute, but it's more of a bond where they allow the individual to pay money up front, basically covering the cost of any potential extradition in the future. There are some other states that are starting to come on board with having some type of an application fee or some type of an upfront cost to cover the potential cost of the retaking.
Brief follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how many states are in the compact?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, 50.
Oh, okay.
All 50 are
Thank
joined.
You.
Massachusetts was the last one to join just a couple of years ago.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, Fran, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 74? Not seeing or hearing anyone come up, we'll close the public hearing. And, Council, do we have the paperwork to entertain a work session on this bill?
Mr. Chair, I'm not seeing it in front of me. Dan, you haven't seen it either, have you?
All right.
Okay.
So that will conclude our work on Senate Bill 74 today, and we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 370.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 370 allows a limited judgment in probate proceedings for awarding expenses to a personal representative, allows a limited judgment in protective proceeding for authorizing payment to persons providing services to protective persons. This has no revenue impact, and it has a minimal fiscal impact, and the committee will remember that's less than $10,000, and it's ready to move with no amendment if the committee so chooses. Thank you.
Thank you. Ryan Gibb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Gibb. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I'm the past chair of the Elder Law Section of the Oregon State Bar, and I'm the chair of the subcommittee of the Elder Law Section. The primary focus of my practice is elder law, dealing with a variety of legal issues, including probates, guardianships, conservatorships, trusts, typical estates. I also represent protected persons in conservatorships and guardianships, as well as beneficiaries in estates. I'm here today in support of the bill proposed by the Elder Law Section, which is Senate Bill 370. Currently, Oregon probate law and guardianship conservatorship law allows the court to enter an order awarding attorney fees or fiduciary fees in estates and in guardianships and conservatorships. However, the law does not specify that that award can be reduced to a judgment. Therefore, the court's order is subject to the personal representative or the conservator's actual willingness to pay that or face later court sanctions. But there is no actual security that the attorney is granted under current law, or that the fiduciary is granted. The proposed bill would allow the court, in circumstances that the court determines appropriate, to enter a limited judgment awarding attorney fees or fiduciary fees in cases that the court determines it would be beneficial to add some security to the award, so that the fiduciary or the attorney can be better assured of receiving payment of the fees that the court has already awarded. This bill, we don't see will have any likelihood of adding attorney fees or adding fiduciary fees beyond what the court is already awarding in its orders. This simply will give the court another means to ensure that those fees are going to be paid at some point. The most common situation where this would arise is in a probate or a guardianship or conservatorship where the primary asset is not liquid, such as real property. If the court awards fiduciary fees or attorney fees, those fees may not be able to be paid immediately. If the probate or the guardianship or conservatorship is closed, then the attorney or the fiduciary may have trouble getting paid later on. If those fees are reduced to a limited judgment, they become a judgment and become a lien, and later on when that real property is sold, those fees are going to be paid through the normal course of clearing the title on that property. This bill is proposed by the Elder Law Section. It has been discussed with the Estate Planning Section and the Oregon Bankers Association, who asked that we include fiduciaries in this, and that has been done. So the Elder Law Section and I would encourage this committee to move this along and allow this to go to the full Senate with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? You're off the hook.
Thank you very much.
All right. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate 370? Not seeing anyone coming forward, we'll close the public hearing, and we'll open a work session with Senate Bill 370. And Chair will entertain a motion regarding this bill.
Mr. Chair?
I move Senate Bill 370 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonamici moves Senate Bill 370 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Wissett, if you'd be so kind to carry this one, we'll try to get you back up on the competition as who gets to carry the most bills and judiciary. I noticed yesterday when we were on the floor, I was looking at the list, and Wissett's name wasn't on there. He said he's been being low, so we just want to make sure we don't forget all of our members. So thank you very much. And so that does, we'll close the work session on 370 if I haven't done so. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 371.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 371 revises the Oregon Uniform Trust Code. On this one, we have not received any information from fiscal, and I expect a revenue statement, which will be new for me after three sessions here. I haven't seen one before, so so we have that to look forward to. There is no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Chris Klein. Mr. Klein. When you're ready.
Chair Przoski, members of the committee, my name is Christopher Klein. I'm a vice president of the Estate Planning and Administration section of the Oregon State Bar, and I'm appearing in that capacity. The proposed legislation in Senate Bill 371 would make some technical corrections to the Oregon Uniform Trust Code, which was passed in 2005. That legislation adopted some fairly sweeping changes to the law of Oregon trusts. It adopted many of the principles set forth in the Uniform Trust Code, but also pulled in some older Oregon law that we felt was important to maintain. As with any significantly large piece of legislation, there were a few things that we didn't quite get right, so we'd like to come back and take care of those. The first and most significant change is actually not a technical correction. It's an addition to the law of trusts with regard to trust advisors. Very often, lawyers will add additional people to supervise the administration of a trust who are not trustees. They're often called trust protectors or something of that sort. The idea being that you have one individual that you'd really like to have be the trustee, but there might be certain discrete decisions such as investments or distributions that you want someone else to handle instead. And the problem is that there's not really any clear law on what the status of those people are, whether they're fiduciaries, whether they're non-fiduciaries. And the law in Delaware allows for what's known as a directed trust, which is a provision that you would put forth in a trust agreement that says essentially that it identifies a person that can act as an advisor with respect to certain discrete decisions. That person is a fiduciary with respect to those decisions unless the agreement says otherwise, and the trustee is not liable for any acts taken by that advisor. So it allows the advisor to act without the supervision of the trustee. And it puts the responsibility down on that advisor for those decisions. So that is one change that is not a technical correction.
And before you go on, let's just clarify. If you have someone that's going to be designated as an advisor in the normal course, they will have a fiduciary duty, and they would act independent of the trustee.
Correct.
And then could you explain, in your testimony you stated that unless it's different, so another different scenario would be that they would be an advisor, but the trustee would agree not to require them to be fiduciaries, and the trustee would stay in that position, would be responsible for the decisions of the advisor?
Chair Przoski, it would be slightly different than that. The entire relationship has to be set forth in the trust agreement so that the trustee doesn't have the discretion to decide.
Okay.
The person creating the trust would say, you are or you are not in a fiduciary position. So you could lessen the standard that the advisor is held to if it's done by the person who creates the trust in the agreement itself.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
The next change is a technical correction, and it deals with the modification of existing irrevocable trusts. Prior to 2005, the law in Oregon was that you could modify the terms of an irrevocable trust by written agreement without the approval of a court if everybody, including the trustee and all of the beneficiaries, current and remainder beneficiaries, agreed to do so. And this is very useful in the case where unintended circumstances came up in the administration of the trust that maybe required the terms to be changed. It's also very helpful to resolve disputes among beneficiaries. When we adopted the Oregon Uniform Trust Code, we inadvertently made the standard more difficult to do this. That is, if you wanted to modify a trust and the person who created the trust had died, you had to get court approval for that modification. If the grantor of the trust was not participating. So this change would take us back to the place we were prior to 2005, so that as long as you get the approval of all the beneficiaries and the trustee, you can go ahead and modify the trust. The next change deals with notice to beneficiaries of a trust. The Oregon Uniform Trust Code enacted a more stringent notice requirement on beneficiaries of trusts. It imposed a notice to the beneficiaries on the trustees. You have to give all beneficiaries of an irrevocable trust the notice that they have the right to accounting information and a copy of the trust agreement. And that probably was the case in common law anyway. You probably had that responsibility, but this statute makes it clear that you have to do so. The problem comes with the case where you have maybe a revocable trust that's acting as your will substitute, and you are making a very small gift to someone just to recognize them, but not as a significant part of your estate. So, for example, the stereotypical case would be where I give $1 to my wayward son who doesn't call me anymore, and I give everything else to my daughter, which is
what dads do.
Not uncommon. In that case, the wayward son who gets a dollar has a right to the trust agreement and a copy of the financials and everything else. And we've had several attorneys come back to the section telling us that those beneficiaries are digging into the information simply to be vexatious to the favored child or beneficiary. And so what this change would do is eliminate the requirement of notice if you are the beneficiary of a specific gift, that is a specific dollar amount or a specific piece of property, and that gift is satisfied within 6 months of the date of death or whenever. So if you can
love it,
pay the person off, you can get them out of your hair, and then you don't have to divulge all the other information.
That's what I said. I really, really meant it.
And if it's a specific gift that's larger or it's a complicated estate, then and you can't satisfy it within 6 months, then the notice period does kick back in and you do have to inform the beneficiary of what's going on.
Sibling rivalry.
Finally, there's a number of other more minor changes. We were clarified the definition of a charitable trust and a revocable trust for purposes of the statute. We clarified the identity of the courts that have jurisdiction over trust matters. In a couple of the smaller counties, it's not the circuit court. The probate court resides elsewhere. And so this is just cleans that up. There was a typo in the law of Cypre dealing with how a court can correct a charitable gift that has failed for some reason. And so we correct that. And then we've also changed the references to certain federal statutes to 2008 rather than the older reference. And that has no impact. It's just to tidy up the cross-references. With respect to the fiscal impact, I don't see anything that would cause a problem one way or the other. I don't see a cost incurred either way. Thank you. And do you have any questions?
Hey, Chris, thank you. Senator Wissett, why me first? I might have a couple.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Kwasniewski. Do these technical adjustments create significant increased cost to administer Oregon Uniform Trust Code?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Whitsitt, no, it does not. If anything, I think it would decrease the cost. So, for example, you don't have to produce the records in the case of the notice to the specific gift beneficiaries. The cost of modifying is reduced because you no longer have to go to the court and ask the court for approval. So that would actually reduce the cost to all of the parties and then presumably to the state as well because you're not clogging up the court's docket. And then finally, the directed trust provision probably reduces cost in the sense that you're able to clarify right up front what the roles of the parties are. So again, you wouldn't have to go to court to do so.
Follow up, please.
Yes.
Page 6, sub 7A, creates two new fees among the technical adjustments to this uniform code. And without paying those fees, it says that they are not considered filed. First, should we have a fee bill buried in a technical fix? And second, how do we justify those fees if it doesn't increase the cost?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Whitsitt, the fee provisions were added after the section got to this bill. So to be honest, I'm not entirely sure how they worked their way in. It happened as part of the LC process, and I assume that it was done to harmonize the fees that were in place prior to the changes that were being made.
Mr. Chair Pozanski, that they'll need to work their way out of the bill before I can support it.
All right. Well, I think what I want to do is see if we can get some more clarification, hopefully today, because if Mr. Klein's correct, it could be stating what was already law and just restating it. But it's a question that we do want answered. So any other questions while the bar personnel see if they have that information. Senator Wolf, one or two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just backing up a little bit to the discussion we had about the notice to beneficiaries and the token gift, is it correct that there isn't anything in here that would prohibit discovery of that if there is a challenge to the trust based on some sort of undue influence?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Bonamici, you would receive notice by virtue of the fact that you got the gift that the trust was in place. And so if you had some question about your entitlement to a larger share or someone else prevailing upon the decedent to reduce your gift, you still have all of the rights that you had before in terms of seeking legal redress with the courts. I mean, candidly, there wasn't a lot of options before. So it doesn't change any of those rights of redress.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
All right. And I don't know if we have answers to Senator Whitsitt's questions. And what I'm going to just put on the record, these are noted on page 6 of the bill, lines 23 through 28, actually through 30, because there's another place where they also say something about the fees. So, Council, if you could maybe work with the bar as well as with Legislative Council as to determining where they came from, are they modifications or modifying or new additions to what is already existing. Looking at part of this, it looks like it's basically just authorizing for fees to be collected that are already authorized by law. But there are those specific dollar amounts, mm-hmm. and so we need some answers on that. Mr. Klein, thank you very much for coming forward. I really appreciate your testimony. And anyone else who wants to testify today on Senate Bill 371? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 371. And I believe that takes care of the bills that we have today. Is there anything else that we need to take care of?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right, and that will conclude our work for today. And we're scheduled to be back here on Monday, and I believe that's an 8:30 start.
Yes.
And so we'll adjourn until then.